I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
So, I mean, there's blood everywhere in these hospitals at the moment. We're seeing almost only trauma cases come through the door, and at a scale that's quite difficult to believe. It's a bloodbath, as we said before. It's carnage.
As the death toll tops 21,000 in Gaza, including over 8,000 children, the bombardment has also led to a growing public health catastrophe as disease spreads due to the lack of clean water and medical care. We'll go to Rafah in southern Gaza for an update. Then concerns grow over a wider regional war in the Middle East as Yemen-based Houthi forces vow to continue their attacks on ships in the Red Sea to show solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza.
Coordination around the Gaza war among Arab militant groups, Hezbollah, Hamas, Ansarullah in Yemen, coordinating together, raising each other's capabilities, facing down the Israelis, challenging the Americans. This is a huge story, and it is totally unrecognized in the American media.
Watching the watchdogs, why the West misinterprets Middle East power shifts. We'll speak with Palestinian-American analyst Rami Khoury. And to investigative journalist James Bamford. He asks in The Nation, who's funding Canary Mission inside the doxing operation targeting anti-Zionist students and professors? And we'll look at growing resistance to what some call the Palestine exception to free speech on college campuses.
The most prominent discrimination and harassment on campus has been through not only other students and faculty on campus, but the administration's vilification of Palestinians through these university-wide emails that they've been sending.
We'll hear from a Barnard College student and a professor there who signed a widely shared statement in solidarity in opposition to the repressive climate on U.S. campuses, it was called. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Gaza's health ministry says at least 241 Palestinians have been killed over the past 24 hours. That's 10 an hour as Israel intensifies its assault on Gaza, where the overall death toll has topped 21,000, including 8,000 children. Meanwhile, in the occupied West Bank, an Israeli drone strike has killed six Palestinians in the Ner Shams refugee camp near Tulkarm during an Israeli raid. Al Jazeera reports Israeli forces blocked ambulances from reaching the victims of the strike. The youngest victim was 16 years old. Israeli forces and settlers have killed at least 300 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank since Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th. Egypt's proposed a plan for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza, but on Tuesday, Israel's army chief said Israel's military operation in Gaza will continue for, quote, many more months. Hamas has also rejected elements of the Egyptian proposal. On Tuesday, the bodies of about 80 unidentified Palestinians were buried in a mass grave in Rafah in southern Gaza. Israel had seized the bodies in northern Gaza in order to determine if any of them were dead Israeli hostages. Israel then returned the bodies to Gaza through the Kerem Shalom crossing. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has reportedly endorsed expelling all Palestinians from Gaza. Israeli news outlets report Netanyahu told a group of Israeli lawmakers Monday, quote, regarding voluntary immigration, this is the direction we're going in, he said. Palestinian leaders denounced Netanyahu for embracing what they describe as ethnic cleansing. The 11-week Israeli assault has already forced more than 85% of Palestinians in Gaza to leave their homes, and many have no homes to return to. Displaced Palestinians say there are no safe places remaining in Gaza.
We were displaced. We were bombed by aircraft, and the school was not safe. So we went out, and while we were leaving, there were snipers and people were martyred. We have been out for 2 days, and the situation has not improved. The plane is bombing from above, and the snipers as well.
Israel's bombardment of Gaza has also led to a growing public health catastrophe as disease spreads due to contaminated water supplies, the buildup of untreated sewage, and the lack of medical care. Some Israeli officials have openly praised the spread of diseases in Gaza. In November, retired Major General Gyora Eilon, who still advises Israel's defense minister, wrote, quote, "Severe epidemics in the south of the Gaza Strip will bring victory closer," unquote. The public health crisis in Gaza is also impacting Israeli soldiers. The Times of Israel reports one soldier died after being infected by a harmful fungus in Gaza. At least 10 other Israeli troops were infected after being exposed to soil contaminated with sewage waste. Meanwhile, three more Israeli soldiers have died in Gaza. 154 Israeli soldiers have been killed in Gaza since Israel launched its ground invasion. An 18-year-old Israeli teenager who refused to enlist in the Israeli army has been sentenced to 30 days in prison. Tal Mitnick spoke out against Israel's assault on Gaza before his sentencing Tuesday.
I'm standing today in Tel HaShomer base and I am refusing to enlist. I believe that slaughter cannot solve slaughter. The criminal attack on Gaza won't solve the atrocious slaughter that Hamas executed. Violence won't solve violence, and that is why I refuse.
Israel's announced it will stop automatically granting visas to employees of the United Nations after it accused the UN of being, quote, complicit partners with Hamas. Top United Nations officials have repeatedly called for a ceasefire in Gaza while demanding more humanitarian aid into the besieged territory. The Pentagon saying it intercepted and shot down 12 drone attacks, three anti-ship ballistic missiles, and two land attack cruise missiles launched by Yemeni Houthi forces in the Red Sea during a 10-hour period on Tuesday. This comes as concern grows over a wider regional war in the Middle East. The Houthis have vowed to keep carrying out attacks on ships in the Red Sea to show solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza.
In support of the Palestinian people's oppression, who continue to suffer from killings, destruction, siege, and starvation, the naval forces of the Yemeni armed forces, with the help of Allah, carried out a targeted operation against the commercial ship MSC United using suitable naval missiles.
Ukrainian forces struck a large Russian warship at a port in occupied Crimea on Tuesday in what's been described as one of the most significant attacks against Moscow's Black Sea Fleet in months. But the attack comes as Ukrainian officials have acknowledged Russia has seized the frontline town of Mariinka in eastern Ukraine after a month-long battle in the latest setback to Ukraine's failed counteroffensive. Sweden's a step closer to joining the NATO military alliance. On Tuesday, a parliamentary committee in Turkey approved Sweden's application to join NATO. Turkey's full parliament must now vote on the issue, but a vote has not yet been scheduled. Turkey and Hungary are the only NATO nations which have not yet approved Sweden's bid. Last week, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said the final vote hinges on whether the U.S. Congress approves selling 40 F-16 fighter jets to Turkey. Erdogan's also calling on Canada to lift an arms embargo on Turkey. U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken, Homeland Security Chief Alejandro Mayorkas, and White House Homeland Security Advisor Liz Sherwood Randall are meeting today with Mexican President AMLO, that's Andrés Manuel López Obrador, in Mexico City. Blinken is preparing to discuss what his office has described as border security challenges and, quote, unprecedented irregular migration in the Western Hemisphere, unquote. Andrés Manuel López Obrador is expected to call again for the Biden administration to lift sanctions against Cuba and Venezuela, which AMLO says has driven an increase in migration. This comes as a caravan with over 6,000 migrants are heading towards the U.S.-Mexico border. Some participants in the caravan are holding banners that read, quote, "Exodus from poverty," unquote. Other caravan participants said they're fleeing violence at home. This is Jose Santos from Honduras.
I came here escaping from the MS-13 criminal gang. I worked as a security guard. MS-13 asked us for money, but we didn't have any. They wanted our ammunition. but as guards, we only received a limited amount of ammunition. They threatened to kill me, not once, but three times. I was scared, so I decided to come to Mexico, hoping I'll be allowed to go to the U.S.
In related news, CNN's reporting more than 11,000 people seeking refuge in the United States are waiting in shelters and camps on the Mexican side of the border. Opposition candidates in the Democratic Republic of Congo are accusing the nation's Electoral Commission of committing massive fraud during last week's election. Initial results show incumbent Felix Tshisekedi has a large lead over more than two dozen rivals, including the Nobel Peace Laureate, Dr. Denis Mukwege. Opposition parties have announced plans to defy a ban on election-related protests by staging a march in the capital, Kinshasa, today. In Nigeria, armed groups have killed at least 160 people in a series of attacks on villages in the central Nigerian state of Plateau. Amnesty International criticized the federal government of Nigeria for failing to do more to protect rural communities in the region, which have come under numerous deadly attacks. Japan is moving closer to reopening the world's largest nuclear power plant, which was shut down following the Fukushima nuclear disaster in 2011. Earlier today, Japan's nuclear regulator lifted its safety ban on the plant, which is run by TEPCO, that's Tokyo Electric Power. Local government bodies still need to sign off on the plant's reopening. To see our broadcast from Tokyo, go to democracynow.org. The U.S. State Department has placed several prosecutors in Guatemala on a corruption blacklist over their attempts to block Guatemala's president-elect, Bernardo Arevalo, from taking office. Arevalo, who's scheduled to be inaugurated January 14th, has accused his opponents of waging a slow-motion coup d'etat by attempting to overturn his election victory. The longtime New York activist Ralph Pointer has died. Pointer was a retired New York school teacher who was a longtime advocate for political prisoners and a radio host on Pacifica station WBAI here in New York. He was married to the prominent radical attorney Lynn Stewart, who died in 2017. Ralph Pointer helped lead efforts to free Lynn Stewart, who was jailed for 4 years for distributing press releases on behalf of her jailed client, the Egyptian cleric Omar Abdelrahman. And the acclaimed South Korean actor Lee Sung-kyun has died at the age of 48. He starred in the film Parasite, which in 2020 became the first foreign language film to win Best Picture at the Oscars. Police found Lee Sung-kyun unconscious in a car in Seoul shortly after his wife had reported that he'd left behind what appeared to be a suicide note. He'd been under investigation for violating South Korea's strict drug laws. He was recently questioned by police for 19 hours. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, we had hoped we'd begin today's show in Gaza, where the health ministry says the overall death toll now tops 21,000, including over 8,000 children. But communications in Gaza are now down for the umpteenth time, and neither we nor our colleagues with the Associated Press can reach our guest in Rafah in southern Gaza. As you reported in headlines, the Pentagon is saying it intercepted and shot down 12 drone attacks, 3 anti-ship ballistic missiles, and 2 land attack cruise missiles launched by Houthi forces in the Red Sea during a 10-hour period on Tuesday, as concerns grow over a wider regional war in the Middle East. The Yemen-based Houthis have vowed to keep carrying out attacks on ships in the Red Sea to show solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza. This comes as the Pentagon said it carried out 3 strikes on Iraqi territory Monday at President Biden's direction in response to a drone attack on an airbase in Erbil, Iraq, that wounded 3 U.S. service members, one of them critically. Iraq's government said the U.S. attacks killed one member of the Iraqi security forces and wounded 18 people, including civilians. It condemned the Pentagon's, quote, unacceptable attack on Iraqi sovereignty. Meanwhile, Turkey's military launched airstrikes in northern Iraq and Syria over the weekend, targeting bases, shelters, and oil facilities operated by the Kurdish PKK militia. The attacks came after the Turkish Defense Ministry said 12 of its soldiers were killed in northern Iraq in battles with PKK fighters. Elsewhere, an Israeli airstrike on northern Syria on Monday killed Syed Razi Mousavi, a senior advisor in Iran's new Revolutionary Guard Corps, responsible for coordinating Iran's military alliance with Syria. Iran's foreign ministry condemned the attack, saying, quote, Iran reserves the right to take necessary measures to respond to this action at the appropriate time and place. For more on all of this, we're joined in Boston by Rami Khoury, Palestinian-American journalist, senior public policy fellow at the American University of Beirut. His new piece for Al Jazeera is headlined, Watching the Watchdogs, Why the West Misinterprets Middle East Power Shifts. Well, why don't you tell us why the West misinterprets these power shifts, Rami Khoury? And do you see what's happening in Gaza and the West Bank as leading to a wider Middle East war?
Thank you for having me, and thanks for the great work you do every morning. The second part of your question, I can pretty surely say that I don't expect a wider war. But wider wars don't usually happen by planning. They often happen by accident. So it could happen, but I don't think so, because it's not, first of all, a wider war isn't going to solve anything. Second of all, people generally on all sides don't want to fight a wider war, and certainly civilian populations are against it. For your first question, the short answer of why the mainstream media in the U.S. and most of the Western world doesn't follow, analyze, acknowledge what I think are the biggest geostrategic changes taking place in this Middle East region in the last maybe 30, 40 years. The short answer is that the U.S. and Israel are joined in a kind of subtler colonial assault on Palestinian rights. They have been for half a century. The British and the Zionists started this in the 19-teens, and then Israel was created. And after 67, the U.S. became the main supporter of Israel. So this is a century-long conflict that has pitted Israel, Zionism, and Western supporters against Palestinian rights. Other Arabs got involved, but it's essentially a Palestinian, Israeli-Palestinian Zionist struggle. And the U.S. doesn't want to acknowledge anything, the U.S. mainstream media broadly doesn't want to acknowledge anything that doesn't fit the script that the United States has a righteous policy, that the Israelis have a moral army, that what they're doing is legitimate defense, and that all the other people in the region who challenge them or fight them are either terrorists or just violence-loving Muslims and Arabs beyond any help that anybody can give them. They just love to kill Jews and Americans. So this is the kind of nonsense that permeates so much of the mainstream media. And this is why I mentioned in this column that this tremendously important sign that we had just last week really needs to be appreciated. And that sign was that the Yemeni Ansarullah group, but people call them the Houthis, you know, one sign of good reporting is to use the people's proper name. So Hezbollah, Hamas, Ansarullah, that makes a difference. And so these three groups, Hezbollah, Hamas, and Ansarullah, are part of a regional network of groups, Arab groups, nationally anchored, one in Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in Palestine, Ansarullah in Yemen, who coordinate very closely with each other and coordinate and get assistance from Iran, just as Israel coordinates closely and gets huge amounts of assistance from the U.S. This is how, you know, the world works. But the difference is that Hezbollah and Hamas have already shown that they can develop technical, military, and other capabilities that can check the Israeli-American assault on Palestinian rights. The U.S. and Israel can wipe out the entire Middle East if they want, the entire Arab region with their nuclear weapons and sorry, other facilities, but this wouldn't solve anything. But the U.S. and Israel at some point need to acknowledge that the Palestinian people have rights that are equal to the Israeli people, and the two should live side by side, or if they want to live in one state, that's up to them, but probably two adjacent states. The Hezbollah, Hamas, Ansarullah combination brought us last week to a situation where at one moment, and it's kind of still going on, the U.S. and or Israel were exchanging military fire with Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in Gaza, some other Palestinian groups in the West Bank, Ansarullah in Yemen, the Popular Mobilization Forces, Iranian-backed militant groups in Iraq, and the Syrian government, which is supported by Iran. So the U.S. and Israel were actively engaged, small levels, low levels, but actively engaged in military action against six opponents and six different fronts. But those opponents were all coordinating together. And the more important point is that not just that they coordinate together, but we've seen in Hezbollah and Hamas now and others that they are increasing their technical capabilities steadily and significantly. The Israeli, with its Israel government, with this massive attack against Palestine, using over 500, 2,000-pound bombs, were reported yesterday, and other, massive ethnic cleansing. Everything they've done, they haven't made any significant gains on their three strategic goals, which is to eliminate Hamas, release the hostages, and to bring about a new political situation in Gaza. So this is quite extraordinary. When you get the two of the most powerful militaries in the world, Israel and the United States, with a lot of other militaries supporting them, unable to achieve basic goals after 2.5 months of barbaric attacks, that's pretty significant. And the last point I make here is that one of the reasons they're not able to make significant gains is that these other groups who are these Arab groups who are close to Iran, they work together in something called the Axis of Resistance. This Axis of Resistance is starting to become much more effective in deterring or checking the Israeli-American military and assaults and or the political demands that they want. And we'll see this now in the negotiations that will happen. We're happening now. They're negotiating another exchange of prisoners and hostages and other things. And if there's a peace negotiation that might happen later, you will see the power of this resistance axis manifesting itself politically rather than just militarily. This is a huge, huge development.
Rami Khoury, I wanted to ask you, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal in the past few days, and one of the points that he raised there in terms of the goals of Israel in the assault on Gaza is, to me, a completely new point that he's raised here. He said that not only do they want to destroy Hamas and demilitarize Gaza, but that they want to de-radicalize the Palestinians. In essence, that sounds to me is to stamp out all potential opposition to Israel in the future. Nothing about a long-term settlement of the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. I'm wondering how you reacted to that opinion piece.
I don't take it very seriously. I don't take anything Benjamin Netanyahu says these days very seriously. This is a guy on the run. He's running from the law, his own law in Israel. And the only way that he can stay out of jail is to keep fighting, make himself indispensable by being a tough guy. And all it's doing is killing more Israelis, killing more hostages. The death level among Israeli soldiers in the fighting in Gaza is getting higher and higher. 10, 15 die on some days now. So I don't take anything he says very seriously, neither should anybody else. He is the Prime Minister of Israel, and he does had this barbaric coalition of right-wing fascists that's been let loose now in the West Bank and in Gaza and other places. But I would also make the more important point that when he says that he wants to de-radicalize Palestine, this is in keeping with a century of Zionist lies and propaganda and PR and spin, which the Israelis now do through their government. They have a ministry for international propaganda. And one of their key propaganda techniques, nonstop since the 1920s or 30s, has been to associate any of their foes in the region, whether it's Palestinians or Iranians or Gamal Abdel Nasser or Saddam Hussein or Qaeda or anybody who they might not like in the region, they link them with the most awful person or group that is most awful for people in the West. So with the Palestinians, they Netanyahu has compared them to ISIS, to Qaeda, to Hitler, to, you know, any, he didn't compare them to the Khmer Rouge, but he probably will if you give him time, to any group that does terrible things around the world. He says that's what the Palestinians are like. And the reality is, if you go to any place in Palestine, including Gaza, and you sit with ordinary people, you see that this is a bunch of nonsense. But this is their strategy. One of the critical things that's happening now, and I'm working on a long article on this that'll come out soon, is that along with the ability of the resistance axis and other and popular support, by the way, that they have a lot of popular support in the region, as polling shows us, including 90% of people in Saudi Arabia don't want to make peace with Israel until the Israelis make peace with the Palestinians. And Hamas's popularity has risen. But along with this major development, which I mentioned, the second one, which I think is absolutely critical and explains a lot of the stuff that's happening, not just in the region, but here in the United States, where Palestinians are, you know, thrown out of their jobs because of a tweet they did 2 years ago, or for wearing a scarf that is part of their identity, or for calling for a ceasefire. People are, Palestinians are punished for this. This is because this century-long legacy of Zionist and then Israeli government public relations, spin, diversion, lies, exaggerations, distortions, it's still going on, but it doesn't work as well. They don't fool the world like they used to, because everything they do is out in the open. And you go to your social media and you see everything that the Israelis are doing. It's all now being documented. Files are being prepared for the International Criminal Court. So this is why the Israelis become extremely more violent and more outrageous in their political political statements. And it also explains why I believe that they've focused heavily on the anti-Semitism accusations, which, of course, anti-Semitism and the Holocaust are seen as like the worst human crimes in modern history, even though anti-Semitism goes way back. So they're focusing a lot on anti-Semitism. They accuse people of being anti-Semitic or terrorists, and because most of their other arguments don't work anymore. So this is a really important moment. That's why it's so important now for a credible group of people, not the United States government, which is not credible in this, but a credible group of people that includes the U.S., but not run by the U.S., put together some kind of serious proposal to stop the fighting, get the prisoners and hostages exchanged, released, and start a serious political negotiation that can move the Palestinians and the Israelis and the whole region towards a negotiated permanent peace agreement. It's very hard to do with the existing governments.
I wanted to ask you, you mentioned Saudi Arabia and the 90% support that for the axis of resistance within the country. Could you comment on Saudi Arabia's role right now, for instance, declining to join the coalition that the United States is trying to set up to protect shipping in the Red Sea? What do you make of Saudi Arabia's stance right now?
Well, Saudi Arabia waged war against Yemen for 5 years with American and British technical support, refueling and intelligence and all this stuff. And they lost. They were driven out. The Saudis had to get out of Yemen. The Emiratis got out before because they're even less efficient at warfare. And the Emiratis are hunkered down in South Yemen trying to set up some kind of new country or something there. We don't know what they're doing. The Saudis got out. They understand the capabilities of Ansar Allah and the Yemeni people. Over time, the Yemenis have defeated almost every single person who has tried to come into their country and dominate them or occupy them or order them around. So that's one